generations of Irishmen, and belonged to all who heard them. They had stood the test of time. Yet never had they been in print, for the Irish were not permitted to publish. They were tales told in taverns. I might do another as well, for there were many such stories, but that would probably be the end of it, unless I could enrich my knowledge by talking to road people and gypsies. Where was Corey? I wondered. I could use him now, and could pay him too. Tucking away the £2 with my small store, I went back to the inn, loitering along the way. I saw nothing of anyone I knew, yet I did see a rogue or two who seemed to be following me. Were they Cutting Balls men? Those of Leckenby? Or both? For a week I loitered about the White Hart, the Red Lion, the Mermaid, the Three Tuns, the Golden Lion, King Harry Head, as well as the Bear and the Ragged Staff. I went from one tavern to the next, buying a glass here, or just sitting and watching, sharing a drink with some wandering rascal. But I was listening all the while. Usually, I just listened. If the soil seemed fertile, I might drop the seed of Leckenby's name, and then sit back to hear what might be said. It was a way to learn, and I learned much. Soon I learned that Leckenby directed the affairs of three stalling kens, or places where stolen goods might be sold, each in a different quarter of London. He also had several stables where horses might be let to pads, as highwaymen were called. He had a fist into everything, and he was making enemies all over London. Cutting Ball was not alone in disliking Leckenby or his ways. It was simple to see that he was a master scoundrel. Swiftly, then, I wrote. It was not the whole story, certainly, but it was enough. I entitled it Ralph Leckenby, Thieves Master and Master Thief. Then I hastened to Blackfriars and put it into the hands of Master Field. He looked at it, swore a little, and pressed on to read further. I will take it, he said at last. But do you look to yourself, Tatton Chantry? Once this is on the street, your life will be worth next to nothing. He snapped his fingers. Not that. £4, I said, and I'll wear a loose blade. You will have it, he said, but I fear for you. And in truth, I feared for myself. Chapter 20. Now that I had come up on a means of earning a bit, I did not neglect the pen, but my next two attempts failed of acceptance. These had neither the wit nor the novelty of my first successes. Yet it was about this time that the Leckenby piece was published abroad. In a day, it became the talk of the town. When I went to the tavern below, the place was abuzz with it. And not knowing who might be the author, they were of one mind that he had but a short life left to him, once Leckenby saw the piece. Cutting Ball came hurriedly to the tavern. What? Tatton Chantry? Is it you who had done this thing? You have destroyed him. That was my purpose, but we do not know yet what may happen. We can but wait and see. All London will be about his ears, Ball insisted. And to think that you have done this, a mere lad, and with a pen, too, and with no sword or mob or soldiers. Yet that day went slowly by, and nothing happened. Nor were any of Leckenby's men seen about, nor on the second day. There was no move against him by the Queen's men. There was only talk. On the third day, well armed and with Ball's men about, I ventured into the street. This time I was bound for Blackfriars with another tale of the Merry Damber, which had proved successful. I sold the piece to Master Field for £1, and turned about, planning to go at once to my own tavern. Suddenly, I found myself face to face with Leckenby. He stopped upon the street before me. My hand went to my sword. "If it is to be, let it be here," I said. He laughed. "You mean then to fight me?" he roared, laughing the while. "Do not be a fool. You have done me only the greatest service. Why, had I ordered the piece written, it could not have been better." He was chuckling and cheerful. I stared at him incredulously. "Take your hand from your sword," he said. "I shall certainly kill you one day, be sure of that. But not today, when you have just done for me what I could not do for myself." "What do you mean?" He chuckled again. "Come, I'll split a bottle with you, and a haunch of beef as well. Don't you see? You have made me sound so powerful, so evil, so revengeful, that my enemies are trembling. A dozen thieves have come to my stalling kens, whom I never laid eyes on before, although I knew them well by reputation. Suddenly, I have gained respect in quarters where there was little before. At one fell swoop, you have made me the strongest man in London. And to think that was all it needed. I am a fool, Chantry, a double-dyed fool. Now I have no need to destroy enemies who believe themselves o'ermatched and have come to me, pleading the wish to join me. What I could not have done in months, you have done in an instant. It is magic." We sat down across the table from each other. The confusion in my thoughts cleared. In believing I was destroying a monster, I had created a worse one. In speaking of his strength, I had made him seem more fearful than he was, and frightened all who would oppose him. He bought good wine and filled a glass for me, and the beef we had was the best, the tenderest cut of all. He served me from his own blade and laughed, his face flushed from wine and laughter. "Oh, you have done it, Chantry. There's a string of bawdy houses that I've long wanted, ill-kept places, but fat with profits. Now they have asked my protection, and they shall have it." "Oh, they'll have it, all right. And a fat payment through the nose for it, too. Come, drink up, Chantry, and be rid of those men of cutting balls. You'll not need them more, and as for him, this will destroy him, too, or nearly so." As we ate, he ticked off the things the unwanted publicity had brought to him. There were some men he had threatened who had not been convinced of his strength. Yet before he needed to prove it, my piece had appeared and done the task even better. "Much thanks, Chantry. By the Lord Harry, I am glad I did not kill you." He reached into his sash and tossed a sack of gold upon the table. "There, have that. It is little enough for what you have done." "Keep it," I replied shortly. "I'll have none of it, for I meant to destroy you." He laughed again, his eyes bright with malice. "Of course you did. Think you I do not know that? But bother the reason. It is the effect that matters, and the payment there is small enough for what you have done." There was nothing to do but put a good face on it, and think of what I should do next. Cheerful as he was, I could only doubt what he believed, for whatever effect this might have upon evildoers, it was sure to result in some sort of action by those in authority. Unless, of course, they were too occupied with Ireland and worried about Spain to bother with the evil at their doors. "I have also read The Merry Damber," Leckenby said. "It is a good piece, too. You had some tricks there even I had not thought of. Stay about London, Chantry, do, for you will only make things the better." He gnawed on a bone, then put it aside. "Look you, Chantry, I am no fool. I know this dodge will not last forever, but by the time it has worn itself out, I shall be rich. Yes, rich, and I shall have those about who need me, but who are themselves in power. I will buy an estate. I will hire some such a one as you to say that all your words are balderdash, and will show myself a respectable gentleman. I will keep a carriage, for such will soon be the fashion, believe me, and I shall ride to the hounds and be knighted. You will see. My poor father was a country squire, and a good man, most of the time, but he was never knighted or noticed by anyone. And 2 years hence, Tatton Chantry, I will no longer be heard of as such I now am. 2 years I shall lie quiet, while all this is managed by others. Then I shall reappear, hang a few of those who still oppose me, and within the 3rd year I shall be received at court. I have plotted well the route I shall take, and a better one can't be found. I tell you this now, so you can see it begin to happen. Unfortunately, he smiled, you'll not be about to witness the climax. Although I shall miss you, I shall indeed. You will never do it, Leckenby, I said quietly. Before then, I will show you up for the villain you are. He chuckled. Do what you will. The result will not be changed, not one whit. Besides, what can it get you? A few shillings here, a few shillings there, trifling sums, and the poorest of livings, whilst I shall be rolling in wealth. He leaned over the table toward me. Already I have friends. I have power. There are those who sit high in the land who will pull strings for me. Do you think I can be taken? That I shall ever end in Newgate or Tyburn? I am too much needed. When they need something done, I see that it is done, whether here or across the water. At this time, I am a tool to them, to be used. But soon I shall change positions with them. Then they shall be the tools, and I the user. You are ambitious, I said, and ambition may destroy you. Tis a gamble, is it not? The humour was gone from his eyes. I know well the chance that I take, and the need they have of me. I must take each step with care. But you yourself have helped me, for they will read what you have written and measure my usefulness against what you have claimed for me. Now they will need more money when they come to me. He pushed the gold toward me again. Take it. Gold is a useful servant that never talks back. Had I hired you, this could have gone no better, nor come at a better time. He rested his powerful forearms on the table. His wrists were the thickest I had ever seen, and his hands gave a sense of awful power. He was, in his own brutal way, a handsome man. His face suggested power and strength. He motioned to the waiter. A bottle of sack, he said. Your best. Look you, he said suddenly. I like you not, nor you me. But yet you could help me. You are shrewd, and you fight well. Not well enough, he added, but well. Join me. I do not plan that you should become a thief, but rather an agent. Tool? I suggested wryly. We are all tools in one way or another. He leaned toward me. England is changing. Any man with his eyes and ears open knows it. We are coming to power. You shall see. Spain is all powerful now, but Spain has come upon wealth in the wrong way. Too much, too quickly. It will destroy her. Slow growth builds caution into a man or a nation, but sudden wealth is a spoiler. Now gold comes to her by every ship, and the living is easy. The great fighting men who graduated from the ranks of the army that fought the Moors will disappear. The politicians and the courtiers will take over. The gentle ones, the conniving ones. They will rook the fighters out of all they have won. Men like Cortez, Pizarro, Alvarado, and De Soto will disappear. And in their place, the weak ones, the ones grown fat on easy wealth, will come to power. We are a young country, yet very old. We have the men, and we have the ships, and we will win. There are ships to be built, and equipment to be supplied to the ships. The press gangs will be after men and more men. What has all that to do with you? He shrugged, smiling. I shall control it. The supplies will be bought from me or through me. As for the press gangs, I shall direct them. You? He laughed. Who else? Who could do it better? Of course, if we should happen to press into service a few of the gentry who did not want to go, we can always make an arrangement. And I? I asked. What role have you planned for me? To write when I need something written. You have made me out to be a king of thieves. Now I wish another broadside turned out. This one will deny that I am a thief, but will imply that I am a man of great but mysterious power, that I merely have a wide knowledge of what takes place, and have been able to recover stolen goods from time to time. Protest that I am a good man, but one who has great power in many quarters. I see. The thieves and the bawds have already had their message. Now you want to clean up the picture of yourself, while implying you have still greater power. Exactly. And of course, when people come to me to recover their stolen goods, I shall recover them, for a price. I am sorry about the cost, but the man who reaches the thieves must be paid. And you will have it both ways. A friend to the thieves, and a recoverer of stolen goods, and well paid by both. He laughed with genuine amusement. See how easy it is. In the end, I shall be knighted, and perhaps will stand for Parliament. For you see, I shall also be serving Her Majesty. Even now, there is talk in Spain of a great fleet of ships, an armada, to sail against England. My spies tell me this, and I pass it on to those close to Her Majesty, so that she also knows. To Walsingham? He laughed again. Perhaps. And is he your protector? The laughter died. Protector? I have no protector. I need none. I stand alone. Yet it seemed to me there was a false note in the statement, and when I finished my sack and parted from him, he stared sullenly after me. I believe I had reminded him of something he wished to forget. Cutting Ball's men fell in around me. That worried me a bit, for how far could I trust Ball? And why, even at Green's behest, should he serve me in this manner? For that matter, who and what was I to Green? I would do well to keep a loose sword in my scabbard. I was thinking of that when suddenly a voice spoke from an alley. Tat! I must see you. It was Paget. At the Boar's Head. I spoke softly, but hoped he heard me, continuing on without missing a step. There had been anxiety in his tone, and I knew he was my friend. What now, I wondered? What more could come? Much, I realized well. I wished no association with Ralph Leckenby or his kind. It might be true that what I had written had done him good rather than ill. Some might read it as an evidence of his power, but others would know better, for a thief exposed is a thief soon taken. When Cutting Ball's men left me at my inn and vanished into the night, I took a side door into a dark alleyway and went on to the Boar's Head. There were few about, and Tusty sat alone toward the back of the room. I went to him. "You keep late hours," I suggested. "I am received of a message," Tosti said. "For you? Why not directly to me?" He shrugged. "I do not know. The man came to me. I did not like him, but he was not one to trifle with. You were to come to a certain place, and you were not to be followed." "And for what?" "There is one who wishes to speak to you of a private matter. He would give no name." "I do not like it, Tosti." "Nor I, my friend. But I think you have no choice. I think this man has power, for his messenger was a soldier, or had been. He carried himself well and knew what he was about. One who can command such a person is no ordinary man. All right. I made a decision suddenly. After all, I carried a sword and a dagger. I shall see him. I was directed to a street of quiet elegance, entering the gate, which stood open. I went to the door and used the brass door knocker. The door opened almost at once, and a man stood facing me. No doubt the one who had delivered the message to Tosti.
You are?
Tatton Chantry. I was asked to come here.
This way.
He indicated a door at the end of a short hall. As I stepped inside, he looked past me. The street was empty, as I well knew. Then he led me down the hall, rapped lightly at a door, opened it, and stood aside. The room I faced was rectangular and lined with shelves of books. There was a fire on the hearth. A man of something over medium height stood near a table, an open book before him. As I entered, he did not look up but turned a page, and read a bit more.
"Please be seated."
He looked up then, but not at me. "John, a bit of Malmsey for me." He glanced then at me.
"And for you?"
"The same," I said. "It is a rare wine." "Aye, so it is." He sat down opposite me and crossed his knees. "You know it." "We sometimes drank it at home," I said. "My father would have a butt of it from time to time."
"Ah, and your father was?"
"My father," I said. I knew the man at first glimpse, but he did not know me. Something about me disturbed him, a hint of familiarity, perhaps. I must have changed much in the past few years, but he, almost none at all. The same white hair, the identical features, as if carved from marble, and the same wide, intelligent eyes. "Do I know you?" he asked suddenly.
"No," I replied.
The less of me he knew, or anyone else, the safer I would be. With a hint here, a hint there, a man might well be traced. "You are younger than I expected," he ventured, frowning a little. "You're little more than a boy."
"Age is ever an indefinite thing," I said, "and perhaps the poorest way to estimate or judge, except in wine.
And even there, one finds exceptions." He had done me a favour once, and I was disposed to do one now for him, if the situation permitted. I could not forget that moment at the inn when he had spoken for me and prevented my being cheated. Yet he would have no reason to remember a tired, lonely, and rather untidy boy. "Yes," he mused, "much younger than I expected."
"I have never been older," I commented.
The barest hint of a smile touched his lips, a wry smile. He tasted the Madeira, and I did likewise. It was excellent. My father would have approved. "You have written some pieces," he said. "You seem to know much of cheating." My expression did not change.
"I observe," I replied. "I do not participate."
"I see. And where does one acquire such knowledge?"
"Much of what you wrote in the Damba piece was strange to me."
"There is always something to be learned," I said, and waited. What did he want? Why was I here? The man was obviously a gentleman, a man of means.
"You have lately written a piece about a kind of ringleader of thieves."
"I have." "How did you secure that information?"
"It is quite commonly known about London," I replied.
"And I listen well." He stared at me for a moment, not liking my reply. "Yet you seemed to have some personal knowledge of this man. We had a brief encounter."
"And you are still alive?"
"It was an indecisive battle. However, as you suggest, I am alive." He frowned, and seemed to be wondering just how to proceed. My obvious youth had surprised him. Also the fact that I was of gentle birth. He had not yet succeeded in placing me, and I had a feeling he was one who liked to put things, and people, into their proper niches.
"Having written such a piece, I am surprised you are alive, if this man has the power you suggest." There seemed no appropriate comment for that, and I let it pass. Yet I was puzzled. Who was this man? What did he want with me? Was he a friend of Leckenby? An enemy? Or did he think my writing might be used in composing a broadside of some kind for him? Many such were written and passed out in the streets to advance one cause or another, for there was no other means of getting information about except by gossip. He sipped his wine, and after a bit he said, "This is your means to a living?" "It contributes," I replied. "I do not seem to place you," he muttered. "You are not from London, nor Lancashire, nor Yorkshire." "I am from the Hebrides," I replied, not wishing him to get around to thinking of Ireland. "The Hebrides?" He spoke as if it were the end of the earth, which no doubt it seemed to him. "I did not think there were gentry there." "The MacLeods and the MacDonalds would not like to hear you say so." "Ah, yes, of course." He finished his glass and put it down. I retained at least half of mine, for even Madeira can be heady, and I wished to be thinking clearly. He was puzzled by me. A man accustomed to command, he was now uncertain of how to proceed. I was enjoying myself. The atmosphere was pleasant, the room warm, and I liked the candlelight on the backs of the books. Suddenly he said, "You would like a bit of supper? It grows late, and I have not dined." "I should indeed." Some unseen signal brought John again, and when he departed, my host seemed to relax somewhat. He had not offered a name, nor had anything been said of mine, although obviously he knew it. "I would assume," he said after a moment, "that Leckenby was irritated by your piece." Did he know that I had encountered Leckenby since? I decided he did not, and merely shrugged. "If I were you," he continued, "I would avoid him in the future. You seem an intelligent young man, obviously an able one. There is no reason to run such risks." I sipped my wine and made no reply. What did he want? Such stories could destroy the man.
Or make him even larger.
He glanced at me sharply.
Did he pay you to write the piece? Was that his intention?
He did not pay me. And I do not know his intentions, except...
Except?
Does not every man wish to grow larger? To improve his lot? I have heard rumours that since the piece was published, some of his enemies have yielded and come over to his side. He changed the subject and began to talk casually about troubles with Spain. I listened, offering no comment. He seemed to be merely thinking aloud, but I had a suspicion he was trying to lead me into some comment that would give him a hint or two about me. For some reason, I disturbed him and offended his sense of order. Why was he interested? How had I disturbed him? And then, like a sudden shaft of light into a darkened room, it came to me. He, this man here, must be Ralph Leckenby's protector. Many men in high places, or climbing to high places, had utilised the services of such. It would be very convenient to have thieves at one's beck and call, to steal papers, to frighten, to murder. Now, at least, I had a theory, an inkling of what might be the truth. He needed Leckenby, and I therefore represented a threat. Or perhaps he felt Leckenby was growing too independent, and he wished to know more. John entered with a tray bearing two plates of cold meat, cheese and bread, and two glasses of wine. One plate, one glass, were placed before me, the others before my host. Suddenly, of one thing I was sure. I was not going to drink that wine.
Chapter 21. My host lifted his glass.
"Your health," he said, cheerfully enough. I picked up the remnants of my Malmsey and drank, then put the glass down.
There was some irritation in his glance as he watched me, but he said nothing. I made up my mind to leave as soon as chance offered. This man I did not like, despite the fact that he had befriended me long since. What was on his mind, I did not know, but I suspected he wanted to see what might be among my clothes, and if I had any message that would tell him more of me, or what I was about.
"I have come at your summons," I said at last.
"I do not know what you wish. I thank you for the food, but I shall be going now."
"Sit,"
he spoke sharply, commanding me. "You have written a piece about Ralph Leckenby. I believe that you conspire with him, but whatever you do, I wish no more of this." At a stir behind me, I arose so that none could come at my back.
"I have nothing to do with Leckenby or any other. I am my own man," said I.
Then I thought to warn him off. "Although I have friends enough who wish me well, I shall write what I please. He will see you dead." I laughed.
"Once he has tried to kill me, and several times he has promised it. Think you that another warning will matter?"
My hand rested on my sword. "I bear you no ill will, whoever you are, or whatever you do. I shall go now. Do not send for me again."
"You do not trust me?"
he asked, smiling.
"I will trust you," I said, "if you will drink that wine."
His eyes were not pleasant to see. "That wine? I drank my wine. I want no more. What has wine to do with it?"
"Then let your man drink it."
"There is no need for that," my host protested.
"Very well, then. I shall go."
Then I spoke to John, who barred the door.
"Do you stand aside?"
John made no move. "He seems a good, trusting man, this John of yours." I spoke quietly. "If you wish not to lose him, have him stand aside."
"Bother him," said John. "Let him come at me."
"I do not wish to kill your man," I said, "but I fought more than half an hour with Leckenby." John looked at his master.
"Stand aside then, John," said the man.
"This can be done another time." John stood aside, and I walked past him, ready to turn upon them if need be, but neither moved. When I was outside upon the dark street, I ran a dozen steps quickly and dodged into a lane. Within minutes I was far away, still puzzling over it all, but sure of one thing. The man was somehow allied to Leckenby, and probably his protector. If I had enemies, I wished to know them, and from what corner they might strike. So it behooved me well that I find out this man, and know his name and strength. Tosti Paget was nowhere about when I entered the inn, but Jacob Binns was. I went to him at once, and recounted my experiences. Binns himself had changed. He had filled out somewhat. His eyes were clearer, and for all his years, he was much more agile. He was rested now, of course, and eating with more regularity. He listened without question until my story was complete, then asked several questions. Finally he said, "I know the man. There is always," he began, "a struggle for power, for a place close to the centre. In England, Queen Elizabeth is the power. Make no mistake about it. There are some who believe it is this minister or that, or some favourite or would-be favourite, but such is not the case. The good Queen Bess has things very much in hand. Any who wish to use her had best examine their position with care. There is much pulling and pushing for power. There are some who believe that no woman can be strong, that if close enough, they could manage her. They delude themselves. She is an uncommonly shrewd woman. The man we speak of is one of those reaching for power. Leckenby is a convenient tool. Four persons who would have blocked that man's reach for the throne have had accidents. One, a woman, was struck by a horse racing through a lane and killed. A man fell into the Thames and drowned. At least two others have been killed in duels."
"Duels?"
"Aye. This man of whom we speak has several swordsmen who are in his pay, or who owe him service. One of these is a Captain Charles Tankard. He has killed 5 men in duels in England, another 1 or 2 in France and Italy. He is a skilled swordsman. Better than Leckenby? Who knows? They have not fought, nor met each other, I think, although they serve the same master. He changed the subject suddenly. You spoke once of wishing to make a small venture in trade. Are you still of such a mind?
I am.
There is a vessel being prepared for a trading voyage to the north coast of America. They are not looking for gold, but for something more simple. They seek to trade for furs, and will bring back a few ships' timbers also. The master is a solid man, the vessel a good one.
I have only a few pounds.
It is a start.
Very well.
Whom do I see? He wrote a name on a slip of paper. This woman.
Woman?
Aye, lad. And a shrewd one she is. Her husband was a ship's captain who set himself up in trade, and when he passed on, becoming ill after a surfeit of pickled herring and Rhenish wine, she took up the trade herself. Go to her. She has a number of small ventures and will take yours. I have spoken to her.
Her name?
Delahaye. Emma Delahaye.
It was not until after I left that I realized I had not learned the name of the white-haired man. Emma Delahaye lived in Southwark and had a place of business there. She was a handsome woman of perhaps 40 years, with large dark eyes and a lovely skin. At a desk near her sat a man whom she presented as Mr. Digby, who was her keeper of accounts, runner, and general helper. He was a small man with a dry, wrinkled skin and bright, bird-like eyes. She gave me a receipt for my money, and when I commented that £2 was very little, she shrugged. I know some who are now rich who began with less. She looked at me thoughtfully. You are young. Would you consider going upon a venture yourself?
Not at present, but I have given thought to it.
Give more, she said. She was studying me as we talked. You did the piece on Leckenby, did you not?
And some others.
It was good. We have had no trouble of him yet, but it will come.
Delahaye, I said. It is an uncommon name.
Her features bore no expression, but her eyes were cool.
So is Chantry.
She frowned suddenly.
I have heard the name but once.
It was something told me by my husband. She continued to frown, trying to remember.
Ah, yes, I do recall. It was something about a man lost at sea. Some inquiries about him. But,
she gestured,
that was long ago.
When I returned to the inn, I learned that Jacob Binns had gone. In the months that followed, I saw no more of him, nor of Ralph Leckenby, although his name was spoken abroad now and again. All went quietly with me. I wrote several small pieces and attempted a play, which came to nothing. Discreetly, I made inquiries of Fergus MacCaskill, but could learn nothing. If he had been lost in the Hebrides, I did not know, or killed in battle. My first small venture at sea was a success, and my money was tripled. Adding £2 more, I then divided my investment between 2 ventures to lessen the risk. I was quite sure Emma Delahaye was Irish, but she spoke not of that, nor did I, for to be Irish in England at the time was to be suspect. No good could come of it being bruited about. Certainly I was making my way, yet what I had put by was so little that life was ever from hand to mouth. My clothes were neat, but not rich. I ate with some regularity, and had a bit over for the theatre from time to time. My second attempt at a play was also a failure. Nonetheless, I sold a ballad on the hanging of a highwayman, and another about a pirate. In all this time, I had altered much from the boy who left Ireland behind, for I had grown several inches, and was close on to 6 feet high, tall for my time.
My hair was dark, almost to black, and my eyes of a grey kind. But my skin was darker than many, for I was of the Black Irish on one side of the family. I maintained my skill by fencing 2 or 3 times each week, with any man I could find who wished to cross a blade. Often on the greens, I would have at Tosti Paget with the quarterstaff, for I found him uncommonly good, and also with another man, a burly fellow who was an apprenticed bricklayer named Johnson. Many a good bout we had, and all to keep my skills sharpened, for I had no doubt the time would come when I would have need of them. Knowing that some day I must test my strength against Ralph Leckenby, I worked constantly to increase my skill and agility. Once, after leaving the warehouse of Emma Delahay, I was set upon by thieves, and used them quite roughly, breaking the jaw of one with my fist, and ripping up the second with a dagger. Whether Leckenby was warned by the white-haired man to have no dealings with me, I knew not, but I saw no more of him. By lingering along the riverfront, I soon became familiar with various mariners, men of the sea, and those who dealt with them, and with some of the members of the Muscovy Company. Of these I made inquiry to discover what manner of goods would fare best in trade with foreign lands, for it was here I hoped to make my fortune, if such I was to have. All talk was of piratical raids, the taking of treasure galleons, and such like, but it seemed to me too chancy to warrant the effort and the risk. Trade with America, I learned, was best. Listening to the talk of the savages that lurked in the forests of America, I deemed it wise to acquire a stock of edged tools, needles, copper bells, and brightly coloured cloth. At that time, I also chanced a small venture of my own, exclusive of Emma Delahay. It was a ship to the Baltic lands, and I spent a little on gloves of knit, and leather, linens, and spectacles of the common kind. From these loiterings along the river and talk with mariners, I obtained material for a short piece entitled A True Relation of a Voyage Along the Shores of Muscovy, and What Took Place There. It was only a few years since the return of Anthony Jenkinson from Muscovy, and there was much interest in those lands. A paper paid me a few shillings, and the trade after a few months returned fourfold. I had done well. Carefully, I put by such small sums garnered here and there. I could never be sure of what would transpire in London. Being Irish, I might be at any time found out and forced to flee. Jacob Binns had vanished as mysteriously as he had come, and I was not surprised. I suspected he was a Freemason, although I knew naught of them, only that theirs was a secret society. Unusual sightings, miracles and prodigies of all kinds were exciting to me, and I listened avidly for news of them. There had been extraordinary appearances in October of 1580, and again in the spring of 1583. Strange apparitions were seen in the air, and evil things appeared in storms. I thought much on these happenings, believing little, yet willing to speculate. Several times I turned these happenings into items that could be published, and from each made a few shillings. From a seafaring man in the White Hart, I obtained a story which I soon published, A True Relation of the Frightful Experience of Shipwreck by Hans Goderich, and the Results Thereof. Then from a Spanish prisoner, I obtained a hint of a story which I pursued for some time, resulting in 2 pamphlets, one after the other, entitled A Recital of Events Following Cruel Murder of Inca King, and Vast Treasures Then Buried. Only a day after this last publication, I was leaving the house of Emma Delahay in company with Mr. Digby, when a young girl ran past us, pursued by 2 rough-looking men. They caught her only a few yards on, and commenced to beat her, but before they could strike more than a pair of blows, I was upon them. Seizing the first by the shoulder, I jerked him away and flung him against the side of the house. The other then dropped his hold of the girl and turned on me. He had a sword in his hand in an instant, and he had at me. In no mood to trifle, I parried his blade and ran him through the sword arm. He dropped his blade, cursing me with vile words, while the first man straightened up.
"Ah, what a fool you are to interfere with us! We have those above us who brook no such trifling."
"Are you Leckenby's men?" They were suddenly wary.
"And if we are,"
said the second. "Tell him he would be better attacking men than girls. As for you, if you bother her again, I'll slit your gullets."
"Ah, it is your throat that will be slit. I know you now, and I will speak to those who will have a care for you."
"Get on with you," I replied shortly. They walked away, the one trying to bind up his arm, which was bleeding badly. Mr. Digby shook his head. "Lad, you've but one choice. Be off from London within the hour. The girl was aboard, one of those forced to pay monies to Leckenby and his like. They will permit no interference."
"If they wish to find me, they know where I am," I replied quietly.
"But what I meant to ask Emma Delahaye, I can ask you. What news of the good Catherine?"
"She was sighted not long since, and should be coming up the Thames within the day."
Arriving back at the tavern, I ordered a slice or two of beef, a bit of cheese and bread with a glass of wine, and waited for Tosti Paget. He had scarcely come when another man entered, a tall man, lean and strong. He looked sharply around, then crossed to me.
"You are Chantry?"
His tone was a challenge.
"I am." "We have read your paltry tales of shipwreck and treasure. They are trash, and they are lies, and you yourself are a lawyer."
Suddenly, my initial surprise was gone. Strangely, I was cool.
"And your name?"
"Tankard," he replied.
"Captain Charles Tankard."
"Of course," I said. "I have been expecting you. What took you so long? Or..."
"Were you afraid?"
"Oi? Afraid?"
He was both astonished and angry.
"I am Charles Tankard."
"Indeed. If I were you, I should be ashamed to speak the name. I know of you as a paid murderer, as a creature in the employ of Ralph Leckenby, and perhaps of others. They tell me also," I stood up, "that you are a swordsman. Now, I have no doubt that you came here to kill me,
sent by the masters for whom you run your foul errands. Is not that true?"
He was angry. Coldly, furiously angry. I wanted him so. He was reputed to be dangerous, and no doubt he was. His rage would do him no good, and might make him rash. He started to reply, but I was before him.
"Please," I interrupted.
"If we must fight, let us do so. Your breath is as foul as your manners, and the sooner we have done, the better." I gestured. "There is an inn-yard close by. It will be convenient.
Be hasty now, for your masters will be awaiting the report from the dog they sent to do their bidding."
"No."
It reached him. He rushed at the door.
"Come then," he said. "This is one fight I shall enjoy."
"Briefly, perhaps," I replied. Tosti whispered, aghast,
"That man is Charles Tankard. He's killed a dozen men."
"Then perhaps 13 will be unlucky for him," I said. This was what I had trained for. This was the moment I had known would come. And now, would my hours of fence be enough? Or would I die by the blade that had bled so many others? Now was the moment. The light in the inn-yard was ill. There was night upon us, with only the stars above and some light from windows close about. But enough, enough. The footing would be bad. There were paving blocks about, roughly squared before being set. Yet an easy means of tripping a man. I must be careful. Charles Tankard walked past me and turned, sword in hand. He was a handsome man in a dissolute way, a hardy rogue, no doubt, and experienced at this sort of thing. No matter. I had chosen the moment.
Chapter 22. The air was cool. The inn yard smelled of fresh hay and manure. There was a cart at one side loaded with several casks. A few of the people in the common room trooped out, drinks in hand, to stand as spectators. Tankard slashed the air, whipping his blade this way and that, perhaps to overawe me. He was an inch or two taller than I, hence longer in the arm. There was no measuring of blades. We fought with what we had. At least three of those who came from the common room to watch were henchmen of Leckenby's, a thought I knew I must keep in mind, so as not to present my back to them. Yet Tosti, too, was there, and suddenly possessed of a stout staff.
"I will stand at your back," he suggested. "But have a care."
Surprisingly, I was not nervous. Several times I had fought an actual combat, but never in such a duel as this was to be. Yet it was for skill at such moments that I had trained. Tankard knew naught of me, or little enough. My one strategy should be to lead him to believe me less than I was, hence to make him grow careless. We crossed blades, and he looked at me, sneering slightly.
"What a pity, to die so young."
"Young? I did not consider you so young, Tankard, but it is certainly a pity. Still, better the sword than the gibbet." He moved in, feinting a thrust. I made as if to parry, deliberately clumsy, then retreated a step, as if puzzled by him. He moved in with confidence, and in an instant I knew I was facing a strong fencer with exceptional skill. His point circled, and he stepped in with a quick thrust, low down, and for the groin. That I parried, and almost too late. He came on swiftly, and I was hard put to keep his point away. He drew back after one swift exchange, his point high.
"I shall kill you," he said coolly. "It is almost too easy."
There was little sound from those who watched. They stood about in a loose circle, stepping back occasionally to remove themselves from our way. Then Tankard lunged suddenly, but his boot slipped on a bit of mud or some such, and for a moment he was exposed. My point could easily have had his throat, but I stepped back swiftly, permitting him to recover.
"You were gallant," he said, surprised.
"I am a gentleman, Captain. I will kill you, but I do not indulge in murder."
"Ha! You make me almost regret what I must do."
"If you wish to withdraw, Captain, the choice is yours." He laughed.
"And leave London? I'll not do it. I respect you, Chantry, but I also respect the dead."
He came at me swiftly again, thinking to end it so, but I parried his best attacks. I was learning the true man now, studying him as Fergus MacCaskill had taught me to do. His style of fence was English, with some touches picked up on the continent, but I felt he had grown careless from easy victories. He was sure of himself, a little arrogant. He intended to kill me, and quickly. He moved in skillfully, and attempted a classic cut at the chest, sometimes called a banderole, a flowing, slicing movement. It was a pretty move, spectacular to see, but it held a risk, for it exposed the forearm. In a duel with anyone taught by Corey or MacCaskill, it was a wrong move. My reply was instantaneous, needing no thought. A reply rehearsed so often as to be automatic. My point pierced his arm, slicing through the tendons and driving into his chest. He staggered back, and I quickly withdrew to an on-guard position. Blood streamed from his arm, and there was a darkening stain on his chest. My point had not penetrated deeply, but enough for a serious wound. He caught himself by grasping the cartwheel with his left hand. He clung there, he soared down, although still gripped tightly. Blood ran down his arm and over the blade. I lowered my point, a part of my attention, on his followers.
Tosti stood hard by, and ready.
"Damn it," Tankard said. "I was a fool to try that with you."
"A lovely move, Captain, but a foolish one. Shall we call it quits?"
"I meant to kill you."
"Of course." I wiped my blade. "Another time, perhaps?" Turning, I started toward the inn door. A movement took my eye. It was John, the servant of the white-haired man. His eyes met mine, and he smiled a little, not a friendly smile, but an acknowledging one.
"I was well warned," he said quietly. "You are very good."
"Have you a message for me?" I asked, wondering at his presence. He did not smile this time.
"I came to carry the report of your death," he said.
"I will stand you a drink," I said, "for you'll have a dry welcome on your return."
"I'm obliged," he said, "but another time."
He turned away, then paused.
"You fought well," he said, "but be warned. This was thought to end it. Now it will be murder. You must flee or die."
He walked away, and I went inside with Paget. It had been hot work, and the ale tasted good to a thirsty man. Yet I liked none of it. My skill had been proven to me, but I had not wished it so. My thoughts went to the good Catherine. Had she come in? How had my venture fared? I thought back to my victory. My blade had gone through the forearm, the force of the lunge driving it back against Tankard's body. The point had gone in, but not far. He should recover. Alone in my room, I wiped my blade yet again and dropped into a chair. In a severe test of skill, I had won, yet I liked it not. My room seemed suddenly to be an empty place, only a place to sleep and keep those few small belongings I had. What had I accomplished since coming to London? I had lived. I had earned a few pounds. I had acquired a little knowledge. But aside from Tosti, I had no friends. Emma Delahaye and Mr. Digby were merely business associates, and neither cared for me, nor had any personal interest in me. I was alone, as I had ever been since my father died. My life was empty. The warmth of a home, the love of a girl, these I had not, nor any chance of them, it seemed. Fergus had been a strong, easy-going friend. But where was he? I could go back, but to what? There was nothing for me in Ireland, nor was there here in London. I wanted my own Irish home. I wanted that coast again, and I wanted a love. I was lonely. Now I must go out with a ship, accompany my venture, do my own trading. If I could return with some small wealth, I would go back to my own country and find an Irish girl. So I thought, and so I planned. London had given me time in which to grow. It had enabled me to learn. Now there was nothing for me here any longer. Fear did not drive me, for my victory over Tankard gave me added confidence. Yet why remain where there would be endless attempts to kill me? And I knew they feared me, for I had written of them once, and might do so again. I was not their creature, and what next I might do, they could not know. But suddenly, I knew one last thing I could accomplish. I would write a piece that would destroy Ralph Fleckenby, and then I would go. Yet I asked myself, why did I wish him destroyed? Was it because he had bested me in our long-ago duel? Was it because the man was my announced enemy, and had warned me that he intended to kill me? Reason enough, I told myself. But mine was not that. The man was evil, wholly committed to evil. And although I doubted that he would achieve what he had set out to do, he might. So far as I knew, I alone knew his plans. So far as I was aware, I alone could stop him, or could at least make an attempt. I had the necessary information. I possessed the weapon. Oddly enough, I did not believe that it was he who had set Charles Tankard upon me. Rather, I believed it was that white-haired man, the master of John. Ralph Leckenby would wish to have the pleasure of killing me himself. Yet I recalled the girl I had helped just a few hours past. How many such girls were brutalized, beaten, and held